Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. True stories of the mob skimming from the Las Vegas casinos in the 1970s. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. Highly sought after speaker for college, corporate, and service organization programs. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. We must pay the studio time and Freedom of Information Act requests that we filed with the federal government. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at JenksLaw. Please subscribe to this podcast and review the show. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, folks, for the Gangland Wire Crime Stories. We're here again tonight and in the studios of the Big Dumb Fun Show down here in the deep, dark confines of Studio 4. With my friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, it's good to be back, and you know, we did the Ku Klux Klan. I did the story about the Bowery and the live sex acts on the stage that I almost got to see, and but we didn't have the donkey show that night.
But you were in the room.
I was in the room.
Not for the donkey show.
Not for the donkey show. I was working, Aaron. I was working undercover. But tonight we have a special show for you, and we have a special guest. We're going to go back to in history a little bit, to the Union Station Massacre, and we have with us tonight Terrence O'Malley, one of the more knowledgeable people on 1930s, 1940s gangland history in Kansas City. I'm not real big on that. Mine goes back to the 70s, but he's really an expert on that stuff. And you know,
when you ask people that maybe worked at, say, Chubby's on Broadway,
yeah,
they refer to Terrence O'Malley.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Everybody knows Black Hand Straw Man. All you people out there probably know Black Hand Straw Man. And actually, people got my movie mixed up, Gangland Wire, mixed up with Black Hand Straw Man. It's one reason that I didn't name it Straw Man, the Straw Man Caper, or codename Straw Man, because yeah. I knew it would be even more mixed up. People will ask me, say, well, is that Black Hand movie? And I'll say, no, it's not the Black Hand movie. But anyhow, it was a big hit. It had the longest run of any documentary film, I believe, on local history at the Screenland. Terrence, tell the folks about all the other projects that you've done over the years before we get started.
Okay, sure. And, you know, the way I got into all of this was I was researching Nellie Don. I came out with the film and the book Nellie Don, A Stitch in Time in 2006. We opened it on Mother's Day in 2006. And it was a very, very popular, very successful. It, too, in its year, was the longest-running film in Kansas City that year. What happened was Nellie Don was kidnapped and subsequently rescued by the mafia here in Kansas City. So it was that story that got me interested in researching the mob, because I realized at that time that nobody had really given a decent cinematic treatment to the story of the mafia in Kansas City. And frankly, nobody really had written any books about the mob in Kansas City. And so one of the things that happened is that I was talking a lot with Bill Owsley, the FBI agent who was very instrumental in bringing down the mob in Kansas City. And he was working on a book, and I strongly encouraged him to keep writing and publish his book, Open City, which he did a little bit before Black Hand came out. And then Frank Haig came out with The Mafia and the Machine book And I was real glad to see that, because then I got to take advantage of those two guys and interview them and put them into my film, Black Hand Straw Man.
And stir up some interest in the subject.
That's right. So it all just worked really nicely. And then the other thing that happened was Union Station was looking for a film director for the 75th anniversary of the Union Station massacre, which was in 2008, June 17th, 2008.
We just passed the anniversary, didn't we?
We did. And
82nd anniversary.
They wanted to have a film to commemorate that. And so word had gotten out that I was researching this mafia film in Kansas City. And so they approached me and said, would you do a film on the Union Station massacre? And so I did a deal with them, and I said, yeah, I'll do that. But any research that I get out of your film, I get to use in my film. And so we came.
And they said that was okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it really worked out well, because I was able to kind of kill two birds with one stone in terms as it related to the Union Station massacre. And I'll have to tell you something that I didn't really even know when I started to research the Union Station massacre, whether I would even include it in my story of organized crime in Kansas City. Because I didn't really have a very good appreciation for what the nexus and connection of the event was to organized crime. Because objectively, if you look at the event, it really appears as if it was perpetrated by independent or rogue gangsters, as you might call them.
Sure, correct.
The Yeggs of the day was right. The term that they
appended to them.
Yeah, okay. Y-E-G-G-S. Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm not sure the etymology of that. Yeah,
was that a result of just the Depression? Because we're really talking about the Depression era, and this is...
All the bank robberies. And
traveling
Midwest. Bank robberies?
Well, one of the reasons why, there's a lot of reasons why the Midwest was very popular for bank robberies. But and if you think about this, say that you perpetrated a bank robbery in Phoenix, Arizona in 1933, say. Well, what were there, six roads out of town and they all went into the desert? Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Midwest, through the corridor of crime is what they called it, from basically Texas up through Arkansas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, and then up into Wisconsin and Minnesota. That's kind of the corridor of crime. That's where a lot of rogue gangsters and traveling gangsters.
Who coined that phrase?
I believe that J. Edgar Hoover did.
Called it the corridor of crime.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't heard that one before.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
And so the reason why, though, Bonnie and Clyde and Dillinger and, of course, Pretty Boy Floyd and Harvey Bailey and the Barker Gang and, goes on and on and on. The reason why they stayed in the Midwest was because what they would do is they would create a GIT, and that was a little getaway map, and they would scope out a bank or whatever the target institution was, and then they would devise this getaway, and they would avail themselves of what were called the cat roads. And the cat roads were roads that only a cat could see at night. And these were basically farm roads that farmers would use for their tractors, but they would create these, intricate getaways. So, like, they may say go 325 yards north, then sharp left 212 yards, then south, and they would, have all of these
basically
options.
Off-road.
Off-road, and they could get away real quickly. And so it just worked for them.
Sure, and back then they didn't have radios. The police didn't have radios, and you got across the state line. I remember in that Bonnie and Clyde movie, the police were chasing them, and they said, "Oh, we don't want to mess with them. They're in Oklahoma now."
Well, and that was another thing. There were jurisdictional limitations during the day, and frankly, if you were a local law enforcement officer, why would you want to go chasing, Babyface Nelson across state lines? And, he's a
known killer,
pathological, maniac, and so I think a lot of them were happy to say good riddance, glad that they're no longer here. So that is one of the reasons why we had so many bank robberies, and we had so many gangsters of the era in and around the Kansas City area. Well,
and back to the mafia in mm-hmm. the 30s, Kansas City. And so John Lazy, I believe, was kind of the mob boss at that point in time.
He was the front man for the mob.
He got killed about a year later.
Mm-hmm.
But he pretty well had his finger on all the action. And with these guys like Pretty Boy Floyd, who mm-hmm. was hiding out in town, Vern Miller, rather. Mm-hmm. Vern Miller was the other one. Was hiding out in town at the time. Would the local mafia know about him as a traveling criminal? Would he have to do what they said and lay low? Or if he got in any trouble, would they help him out? Or would they use him to do things and take a piece of the action?
That's exactly what the situation was. Basically, Kansas City was a popular place with professional criminals because it was a machine-controlled town, and the machine was terribly corrupt because it had such a strong ties with organized crime in Kansas City. And, of course, it stemmed from the relationship between Tom Pendergast and Johnny Lazy. And the way that relationship really got off the ground was in 1928 when Lazy, on Election Day, in a relatively minor municipal bond election, kidnapped four of Pendergast's men and held them at gunpoint and threatened to kill them if the Italians didn't get home rule over their own political district. And after boss Tom capitulated, he then essentially was closely associated with organized criminal elements. And as a result, what they did was they operated and ran all the sin businesses in town, the prostitution, the gambling, the illegal liquor manufacturing and distribution, and other various, you know, criminal activities. And Tom Pendergast would get a cut off of all of that. And in exchange, the mafia was allowed to run these businesses. And there was an informal agreement that that they were allowed to perpetrate this kind of ongoing low level of crime. And the attitude was, well, the rich men, the rich people of Kansas City, they have their bars, they have their clubs, they gamble, they drink. You know, would you deprive the average man of his entertainment and his vices? And so there was kind of, a nod-nod, wink-wink attitude toward what were clearly illegal activities during Prohibition. But Kansas City was one of the wettest of that particular dry period, wettest cities at that time. And so as a result, you had this real close relationship between the head of the political organization and the head of the organized criminal organization, Pendergast and Lazia. And so it was a culture here that was attractive to professional criminals to come to Kansas City and lay low, don't pull off any major crimes, don't do any major heists, just behave yourself and you can stay here and we'll leave you alone. And that's basically what the deal was. And so the mob was more or less tasked with keeping big crime under control, and while they were allowed to perpetrate this kind of misdemeanor crime, if you will.
Interesting. And so Vern Miller, who we know will end up in the middle of this Union Station massacre, and he was living out here in what is Brookside today. That house is still out there.
Beautiful home.
Beautiful. I've seen it. Mm-hmm. It's really nice. It's about the 6,600 block of
6612 Edgevale. And I'm sure the people who
Edgevale.
Own it are weary of having their address house photograph. In their home. Yeah.
What is that
is
address
notorious.
Again?
Well, maybe I'll cut
66.
That
66. No, why would you cut that out? Well, that's the truth. I'm sorry, it's his house.
Yeah, but the nice thing is that they've really kept the house up.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah.
Beautiful home. Yeah, they've done a nice job.
And actually, it's all over the internet.
So, yeah, oh, absolutely.
You know, it wouldn't matter for
is it on your is it on your app? Mob
is it
tours.
No, I did not put that. I may have to add that.
You might
to
have
my
to add that
app.
To your Mob Tour app.
Yeah, and then they can come after you for harassment.
Really? So you know, the mafia in Kansas City, in a way, set the scene for the Union Station massacre in some way, not directly involved. I doubt if they knew about it was going to happen because of how it went down. But they set the scene for this to happen.
Yeah, the Union Station massacre was not supposed to happen. It just was a mistake on many, many levels. And it It ended up involving organized crime in Kansas City, simply because organized crime, the leadership was put upon to engage. It's not that they really had any stake in the event, so to speak, but there's a criminal code, if you will, and they were helping out one another. Mm-hmm. But I think we're getting ahead of ourselves in the story, because if you really want to understand this story, and this is why I put it in the film, is that it stars a central character who, but for his interesting character, would just be a footnote in the history of crime in America. But instead, he takes his very important role in crime in America. And, of course, we're talking about Frank Jelly Nash. And the reason why I think he's such a fascinating character is because his criminal career transcended from holding up trains on horseback.
Well, Jesse James.
Yeah, exactly.
In the Midwest?
Yeah, uh-huh. Throughout Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, Texas. And he, as a matter of fact, that's what he was serving his time for when he was at Leavenworth, was for having held up a train that happened to have mail on it. And so that made it a
federal
offense.
Yeah.
And so that's how they were finally able to nail it. But he was a career criminal. He was a bad boy. He got in trouble from, you know, his early days as a young man in Oklahoma. And his middle name, or his nickname, is Jelly.
Jelly, his moniker.
Yeah, and he got that because he was supposedly quite adept and skilled at handling nitroglycerin, which they called jelly back in the day. And so he blew up a lot of bank vaults and things like that. So he was no angel by any means. But what makes him really interesting is not only the fact that, you know, he went from riding horses and holding up trains to riding in fast automobiles with Thompson machine guns and holding up banks. And I mean, it was quite a different approach toward perpetrating your crimes, you know. And so I just think he's an interesting character for that reason. But the other thing that makes
He's an interesting enough character that he actually has a Wikipedia page. Of his own.
A lot of people are interested in him. One of the things is, though, Frank Nash was scrupulous about not getting his photograph taken. There's only, to my knowledge, there really are only two known photographs of Frank Nash. I think I got them both. There's a sketch drawing of him that they were using back in the day, and then there was a picture of his mugshots when he was at Leavenworth, and then there's a picture of when he was wanted for train robberies by the post office.
So he wasn't like Bonnie and Clyde posing
with these
friends.
No, and I mean, no photographs of his childhood. Mm-hmm. There's pictures of the hotel that his dad owned in Hobarth, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's a little bit of a mystery man, but what is in contravention of his avoidance of cameras is the fact that he had this real garrulous personality. He was always the life of the party. He was a back-slapping, happy-go-lucky, you know, let's do it, I'm in, you know, a drinking guy, which served him well because he would always ingratiate himself to his jailers from an early time on, and they liked him. And so in many ways, those who were his captors were, you know, abetted his...
They've been a little bit lax.
Yeah, exactly right, because he had such a disarming personality.
Wait a second. I had read on the Wikipedia, I believe it was, he was the chauffeur for one of the wardens?
At Leavenworth?
Well, at the time of when he walked off his job on October 19th, 1930, he was serving as a chef for the deputy warden of the federal penitentiary at Leavenworth while he was serving a 25-year sentence for bank robbery. And he was at large for 32 months. So not quite 3 years. He was out on the lam.
A lot of people believe when you go to prison, you're just like, you sit in your cell.
No,
yeah.
They give you jobs. You help run the prison and you know, be the chauffeur for the warden or me, chef or whatever. I remember we had a big argument in when I was in intelligence unit, and it was whether Jimmy Duarte was seen in town. They said, "Oh no, he's in Leavenworth," and Bobby Arms says, "Oh no, I saw him down on Broadway." And everybody said, "Oh, you're an idiot," you know. Uh-huh, and so Bobby, not to be undone, he called up to Leavenworth, and they said, "Oh yeah, he drives a bread truck down to pick up supplies for the farm up here once a week."
Unbelievable.
So he would have been in Kansas City.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're not always just sitting there in a cell doing your penance.
No.
Well, but they didn't, you know, like the warden. They were, now it's kind of topical because these guys in New York that helped the murderers escape.
Yeah.
And they're in trouble. Their careers are over. And
it seemed like they had ingratiated themselves with their guards up there or mm-hmm. something. Their guards thought they were good guys and gave them a lot of leeway.
And it's human nature, you know.
It is.
You have to face and deal with and, you know, interact with these people on a daily basis.
You're all in jail.
Yeah. Well, I mean, basically you are.
Yes,
when you serve as a guard in jail. So, so Frank was out on the lam for 32 months, and during that period, he actually came back to Kansas, and he assisted in helping some other convicts escape. And I believe that was, and there were so many of these going on, I believe that one was an escape from Lansing Prison, but it was still in Leavenworth. And he managed to get a bunch of weaponry snuck into the prison. And then, the prisoners who escaped knew where to look for it, and they were able to get their guns. And then they took the warden, and they made their getaway. But so that's one reason why when Frank Nash was picked up down in Hot Springs, Arkansas, on June 16, 1933, and the word went out, hey, they picked up Frank, that the underworld was willing to go to bat for him because he was popular, and he had helped a lot of cons escape and given them safe harbor and helped them hide. And, you know, he was just kind of part of the criminal network, if you will. And so it should come as no surprise that there would be people who would be willing to step up and, give assistance to Frank Nash, mm-hmm. which kind of brings you to the next character of all of this, the guy Vern Miller, who was the polar opposite of Frank Nash. Vern Miller was taciturn. He was stoic. He didn't talk a whole lot. He would get upset when people would use foul language around women. Mm. He had these kind of, turn of the century patrician ideals of, how people should behave in society. Mm-hmm. And Vern Miller's background was he was raised in South Dakota, and he was a sharpshooter during World War I. And he came back, and he was the sheriff of a small town in...
he was from Kimball, South Dakota.
Mm-hmm. And then...
Where was the sheriff at?
He was at Huron?
Beatlesburg or something like that.
I've always said there's a fine line between the cops and the crooks sometimes.
Oh yeah.
Well, he was the sheriff. How
to...
is that where he's, you know, goes and ends up in this life of crime?
Yes. Well, see, and that's what makes his story so fascinating is because of the fact that it was Beadle County. That's where he was
Beadle County Sheriff.
Beadle County in South Dakota. And so he was a decorated marksman and sniper in World War I and was awarded the French Cross of War for bravery by the French government. And then he came back to Beadle County and was the sheriff, but he embezzled $2,000 in 1922. And so he was sent to prison. And basically when he came out of prison, he was essentially a criminal. He could not be entrusted to be a law enforcement officer, obviously. And Vern Miller then hired himself out to known organized criminal entities like the Purple Gang in Detroit. And then, of course, he was a gunner for Al Capone's outfit in Chicago. And it was said that he could operate a machine gun so efficiently that he could shoot his initials with a machine gun.
He could sign his name?
Yeah,
cool.
Sort of. Yeah, like a VM. And so anyway, Vern Miller and Frank Nash became...
Yeah, how did they know each other?
Yeah, well, they became part of a gang that was up in Chicago and up in Minnesota that included a lot of lesser-known... the Holden Keating gang is one of them, and you know some people that were not as famous. But George Machine Gun Kelly was part of this gang, and they spent a lot of time together in Chicago, and they spent a lot of time together in St. Paul, Minnesota. And so Vern Miller and Frank Nash robbed a lot of banks together with various other people. And so,
it's understandable why he would be the guy that would, if he was around, he'd call on to help break him out of
absolutely.
Custody.
Well, what's odd when you say they rob banks with other people, and you kind of read some of the backstory, like on Wikipedia. I was doing this the other night, and Frank Nash killed a lot of the other people that were involved in the robberies.
You mean his co-conspirators?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. His life of crime actually began with the murder of a guy named Nolly Wortman in.
That's a great name.
Yeah. In Oklahoma, and so, yeah, he was not above.
Is that where I think that's the person I'm thinking of? Was there they robbed a bank and then they were going to hide the money and Nolly was digging to hide the money and Frank
just
shot him in the back.
Yeah, was no longer trustworthy. And so Frank executed him.
But Vern Miller didn't seem to have a problem with this.
Well, this was actually that particular event was before they knew each other. Time that Frank Nash went to the Oklahoma State Penitentiary was for that event. But subsequent events, I don't think that Frank Nash was known for being a particularly, psychopathic killer. You know, like a babyface Nelson was.
Yeah, right. That guy probably tried to cheat him more than likely.
Yeah. I mean, there's something,
that happens a lot.
When those things would go down, then, they took care of business the way they needed to. But, Frank was a more sociable and more outgoing and likable personality than a lot of the people that he ran with.
Folks, we have a new sponsor, First Call. First Call's mission is to reduce the impact of alcohol, drugs, and addiction by providing quality resources to individuals, families, and the community. First Call operates a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week crisis call hotline, 816-361-5900. You may also contact First Call through their website, www.firstcallkc.org. First Call's flagship program is called How to Cope. Many folks have called in and asked this question: how do I cope with my father, husband, wife, daughter, son, grandparent, or some other loved one's addiction? First Call counselors conduct a special 7-session program for loved ones of persons with addiction problems. They teach them how to cope. First Call is the first call to find addiction recovery counselors and treatment centers, all things related to recovery from addiction. Remember, call First Call, 816-361-5900, or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. Now, on with the story.
And Terrence, going back to that arrest in Hot Springs, none of this would happen if it had not been for that arrest. Mm-hmm. He had been on the run from Leavenworth for a while, for a year or more. He had helped some other people break out of Lansing. He probably had done some robberies. Did he have a crew going at that time when they were doing robberies?
No, he did not. As a matter of fact, they had split up from the Heat in Chicago. When I say they, I'm talking about Vern Miller and Frank Nash and then other people. And they had all just split and gone their different ways. And so Frank Nash was hiding out laying low in Hot Springs, Arkansas, which was part of the corridor of crime, and that was in many ways like Kansas City in the sense that it was safe harbor.
Yeah, talk a little bit about Hot Springs. That was a hotbed of criminals down there, and it was they basically had sanctuary, even more than in Kansas City.
Yeah, it was a notorious haven for criminals to lay low, and people like Richard Galatis, who was the owner of the White Front Cigar Store in Hot Springs, he ran this pool hall and kind of like you might call a C store today, a convenience store.
Oh, yeah.
Cigar store. And basically it was a hideout or it was a hangout for unsavory characters like Frank Nash. And essentially that's where Frank Nash was when the two FBI agents who were tracking Frank Nash's movements, Joe Lackey and Frank Smith, and they enlisted the help of a gentleman named Otto Reed, who was the police chief of McAlester, Oklahoma, to help them go arrest.
What, did Otto Reed know what he looked like?
Yeah,
something?
And that's why, is because Frank Nash at the time, he was bald. Just like you, Gary.
Yeah. Folks out there, you have to envision that. Or look at my website, www.ganglandwire.com. I'm just teasing.
He looks just like Frank Nash.
Well, but the two FBI agents, they didn't know what he looked like.
Well, they didn't know him well enough. Besides, he was
there
sporting.
There weren't any pictures.
No, there were hardly any pictures. Yeah. I mean, he was sporting a wig, and he had a mustache at the
interesting.
Time. And so it was interesting. So they snatched him. There at the, and they were very nervous because of the corrupt environment there in Hot Springs. And when they snatched him, this Richard Galatis, he actually contacted the local constabulary, and they were going to try and, in fact, they did get stopped on their way out of town by the local gendarme. And basically, the federal agents flipped up their badges at him and said, hey, "We're federal agents, and we're recapturing him." And I think the local guys went, "Whoa, we're not going to get involved in this." You know,
oh, interesting.
Yeah, this
interesting.
Isn't
that
he's
wasn't
not being kidnapped
widely
by
reported?
Some other gangsters. Yeah. You know,
was that very widely reported that had happened?
Oh yeah, that was pretty well known.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what happens is then that he gets snatched there at, or I should say rearrested, apprehended, those would be the proper terms, there in front of the White Front Cigar Store. And his putative wife at that time was a woman named Frances Nash. And I say putative because Frank had been married before, but just kind of forgot to do anything about the marriage. And so
now, folks, putative, that's a lawyer word, and yes, that means possible.
Yes, there you go. And so Frances Nash, she gets all hysterical. She's living there in Hot Springs with Frank Nash, and the way that Frances Nash and Frank Nash hooked up was she was actually a waitress, bartendress at Doc Stacy's place in Chicago, and that was a place where they used to hang out quite a bit.
So this Doc Stacy that mm-hmm. gets involved in this little conspiracy, he was from Chicago.
Yes,
so,
he
so
was.
So this went from Hot Springs to Chicago to Kansas City to put it together.
Yes, it did.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing that they could, in such a short amount of time, that they could trace the communications among the various actors here. And Doc Stacy, he ran a tavern in Chicago that was basically a place for, you know, criminals to hang out. And
it was a speakeasy? Because this was still during Prohibition.
This was during Prohibition.
It is during Prohibition. Prohibition ends in November of 1933, and the Union Station Massacre occurred on June 17th, 1933, so it was during Prohibition.
So it probably was a speakeasy in Chicago.
So
Galatis in Hot Springs then calls Frank Stacy. I think he's called Doc Stacy in Chicago.
Yeah, to me, the proper pronunciation would be Stacy because he's Italian, you
correct.
Know, but I've heard it anglicized to be Stacy. But yes, that's essentially it. What Richard Galatis, the owner of the White Front Cigar Store in Hot Springs, he chartered a Ryan monoplane to take Francis Nash, Jelly's wife, and her daughter, Donella, to Joplin, Missouri, where the lawmen with prisoner Nash were supposed to be passing through. But at the last moment, Gladys hops in the plane to go to Joplin with them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that story before. Boy, this guy must have been valuable to them. I mean,
And
he was doing something. He was making somebody some money.
Well, but boy, did he come to regret that move, because that really cemented his participation in all of this. Yeah. And so then they met up in Joplin, which, of course, was another fairly notorious place for criminals to come and lay low, and they would go to places like Herbert Deffy Farmer and his wife Esther. They had a little farmhouse outside of Joplin, and Bonnie and Clyde went through there.
Oh, that's the Joplin place that Bonnie and Clyde stayed
in.
It was like a hideout.
Do you have an address for that?
if it still exists. But I don't know if you've ever heard of a guy named Wilbur the Tri-State Terror Underhill.
I have not.
He was a bad boy, and he's one of the guys that escaped from Lansing.
Wow.
And interestingly enough, this story has so many tentacles to it.
It does.
Frank Smith, who was one of the FBI agents who was in the Caffrey car at the Union Station massacre, who was not injured. 6 months later, he was involved in the tracking and the shootout, and I believe he killed Wilbur Underhill, the Tri-State Terror.
Wow.
Yeah. So these were the men that were tracking them. The FBI agents were certainly as seasoned at what they did as were the criminals who were out there. These are tough guys, is what I'm saying.
And the rules weren't the same back then as they are now.
When you look at the time period, a lot of these gentlemen, like Vern Miller, had served time during World War One.
Yes.
So they had actual combat experience.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Be it they were officers or criminals.
Well, he really was living what you might consider a conventional life while he was the sheriff, but he just chose to do something that was stupid, which was to embezzle a couple of thousand dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, it broke up his marriage, and it put him on the road as a criminal, basically, and literally put him on the road. He left South Dakota and went going. Now, so what's interesting about all of this, though, is that when that plane arrives in Joplin, Missouri, and it's got Frances Nash on it and her daughter, and it's got Gladys on it, Richard Gladys, and they're meeting up with Deffy Farmer. That's D-E-A-F-Y. And the reason why he's called Deffy is because he was mostly deaf. Yeah, he didn't hear real well. But he and Frank Nash had been incarcerated together when Frank first served his sentence for killing Nolly Wharton. And
that was in Oklahoma.
Yeah. So again, just when I speak to live audiences about the Union Station massacre, and I'm asked to present it, I always tell people there are so many characters in this story.
Just relax.
It is just a real fuster cluck to try and tell this story, because you got all these different players that play important roles in the story.
You almost need a flow chart.
Really?
Well, and then that's what I did in my book, was I actually created one, kind of a timeline flow, you know, to show, okay, so here's where this person comes in, here's where that person comes in. And so what we got then is we got the...
Yeah, let's go back to Joplin.
Okay.
They land the plane, and they're trying to intercept the train.
And then phone calls start happening from Joplin to Doc Stacy's place in Chicago. Doc Stacy calls a local hood here in Kansas City whose name is Fritz Malloy. Now, Fritz Malloy is the great uncle of several Kansas City police officers.
I know several of them.
The Malloy family,
yes.
Right. But Fritz, as a matter of fact, Eddie Malloy, what the heck? I'm going to say, Eddie, I'm talking about you, buddy. He said he didn't even know he had an Uncle Fritz Malloy. They wouldn't talk about him.
I bet not.
Yeah. He said that this was one tough son of a gun. He used to, for exercise, he used to swim the breadth of the Missouri River.
He was a tough dude.
Yeah, he was a tough guy. And so you got, they land in Joplin, they call Doc Stacy in Chicago, they get hold of Fritz Malloy and tell them that, look, they've apprehended Frank Nash. And so then Fritz Malloy goes and finds Vern Miller on a golf course here in Kansas City and pulls him off the golf course and tells him, look, Frank Nash has been recaptured, rearrested, and they're going to bring him through Kansas City the next morning. Now, you may be asking the question, why did they go to Joplin? Originally, the officers were going to take Frank Nash through Joplin, but instead of getting on the Joplin train, they decided to take a different train.
Was
they
never went through out of Fort Smith, Arkansas?
Yeah, Fort Smith, right. And so
the Fort Smith train it went straight to Kansas City.
Yes, exactly. And so there was no stop in Joplin.
I remember
right.
now.
Exactly. So that explains why all those people were assembled in Joplin, is because they were anticipating Frank was going to come through there, and so they were going to try and liberate him in Joplin. Well, that all, it didn't work.
Right.
They quickly found out that, no, the train's going to be traveling all night and be in Kansas City in the morning. And so Vern Miller gets pulled off the golf course.
This would have been June the 16th.
Yes, that's
June
right. Now, so what's going on? What else is going on? And this is what's fascinating about it, is that the parallel to all of this is that early in the morning in Missouri, Pretty Boy Floyd and Adam Ricchetti are on the run together. Adam Ricchetti is Pretty Boy Floyd's 24-year-old alcoholic sidekick. And they're in Bolivar, Missouri. And they're actually having their car worked on at the Bitzer car dealership in Bolivar, Missouri. And the reason why they were there is because Adam Ricchetti's brother worked there as a mechanic. Mm-hmm. And so Pretty Boy Floyd and Adam Ricchetti, it's 7:30 in the morning, Adam Ricchetti's already drunk. He's already been drinking. And so the local constabulary there, a fellow named Jack Killingsworth, was the sheriff of Bolivar, Missouri. He comes strolling into the car dealership basically just to get a cup of coffee and shoot the breeze a little bit. You know, it's a little town. Everybody knows each other, you know.
Well, and they must have known that was Ricchetti's brother.
Well, they didn't know that Pretty Boy Floyd and Adam Ricchetti were there, and or Killingsworth didn't know this, so he innocently goes strolling into the car dealership. Well, Adam Ricchetti is not well composed because he's drunk, and he immediately blurts out, "That's the law," and he pulls out a gun. Yeah. Well, next thing you know, Pretty Boy Floyd has to pull out a gun too. Now they're holding the
sheriff
at gunpoint. And well, now the whole game plan's changed now, because they've escalated this whole thing. Right. And so,
is the car fixed yet?
Yeah, no. So they took a new car, said, well, we're taking a car off the lot, and they put Killingsworth into the car, and they went off into the cat roads of Missouri, and then they were driving for a while, zigzagging back and forth through the, making their way up to Kansas City, and then they took as another hostage a fellow named Walter Griffith, who was a salesman. And so now they're traveling. Ricchetti and Pretty Boy Floyd have Killingsworth and Walter Griffith as hostages as they make their way up to Kansas City. Now, the interesting thing is that a couple of Missouri highway patrolmen had been killed, I believe, either the 14th or 15th of June. Everybody thought Pretty Boy Floyd had done it. And so there was this huge manhunt on for Pretty Boy Floyd.
Logical suspects.
Right.
They were there.
Exactly. But he didn't do it. And they did find...
They find who did it.
Yes, who did it. But nevertheless, so there was this huge manhunt going on for Pretty Boy Floyd. And when I say manhunt, I mean, I'm talking about their planes flying over... head.
Well, so they must have known some of their tactics, taking the cat roads.
Oh yeah, they did. But still, it.
Didn't they switch cars a couple times? The salesman became a captive, didn't they? Because they took his car.
That's exactly right. So they left the Bitzer car dealership car there, abandoned it, and then they were in the Walter Griffith car on their way up to Kansas City, and so you've got this. These parallel events going on that are otherwise disconnected, because Pretty Boy Floyd and Frank Nash did not know each other. Pretty Boy Floyd and Vern Miller did not know each other. They ran in different criminal circles. They were not associated. They were not affiliated. They never met each other. There was no nexus or connection, right, which is what made...
That's going to become important later on, isn't
very
it?
Important, because the FBI is scratching its head saying, well, we think that these are the people that are involved, but how could that be? Because they don't have any connection with,
right,
each other. There's no rationale, you know, for
they
them
hadn't
being
maybe
together.
Heard of each other?
Well, you know, Pretty Boy Floyd by that time, of course,
was pretty
he had a
well
good,
known.
He had a good moniker. That's,
yeah,
what I say,
oh, yeah,
you know, like Vern Miller, he really, right, deserves to be known as well known as anybody, but just to have a good name.
Yeah.
You know,
right,
I mean, you got to have a good name if you're going,
like,
to make that.
It's,
you know,
like Mickey Mantle. He's got,
yeah,
a great baseball name.
Right,
you know?
Legs Diamond.
Legs,
you know,
Diamond,
that's a,
yeah,
gangster name
yeah,
for you right there. You know, Bugsy Siegel,
yeah,
you know, that just works. Lucky Luciano.
Yeah.
Shoot, even in Kansas City, you know.
Tuffy DeLuna.
Yeah, we got Sugar House Pete DiGiovanni, you know.
Yeah.
Scarface. DiGiovanni, yeah. Tuffy DeLuna, Cork Savella. I mean, these,
yeah,
are great names, you know. So
Tony Ripe.
Right. So
great
that,
monikers.
Right. That's Vern Miller's problem. He doesn't have a good name. I mean, you know, he might as well be, what, the Attorney General of Kansas.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yes, he was. Yes. I remember that. Popped out of a trunk to make a drug bust, supposedly.
That's right. Wouldn't let people drink alcohol in
the
Kansas
and the plane,
airspace.
Right.
Yeah.
And the planes went over. That was, I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
So we've got all these guys are converging on Kansas City.
Right.
You know, and why don't we, let's go ahead and wind that down right now, and then we will reconvene and we'll do the day of the massacre, because that's an important day.
Okay, yeah, well, let's get there. We'll set
so
the stage
let's
for
get
all
there.
We're still actually there, because
the
they're still really the federal agents still on the train. Still, you know,
right,
once
yes,
they're on a train, they're pretty locked in because it's a nonstop
that's right,
train.
Yeah, and there's three of them. So you got two federal agents. You got Joe Lackey, Frank Smith, and then you have Otto Reed, who is the McAllister, Oklahoma sheriff.
And he stays on for the ride.
He does. He wants to see Frank make it back to his home in Leavenworth, Kansas, courtesy of the federal government. And so they're on the train, Pretty Boy Floyd and Adam Ricchetti with Walter Griffith and Sheriff Jack Killingsworth are making their way up to Kansas City. And it's really interesting because they took breaks and they took picnics together, and they stopped, and Killingsworth said that, and he talked at length with Pretty Boy Floyd, who waxed nostalgically and reflectively over his life and what had led him to where he was and how he regretted a lot of his actions and how he had a little boy that he cared about so much, which all of which was true, and that he didn't really mean for things to turn out this way. It's just the way that it did. And that he didn't mean to be, you know, mean to people, and he didn't want to hurt anybody or anything like that. But, you know, sometimes, you know, they had to do things that, you know, obviously resulted in people getting hurt. And Killingsworth, he later described it. He said that me and Pretty Boy Floyd, we come to become plum good friends.
Just a good old boy.
Yeah. I just love that. Plum good friends.
Really?
A great idiomatic bit of speech. But so you have these separate parties making their way to Kansas City, and what happens is Pretty Boy Floyd and Adam Ricchetti arrive with Walter Griffith and Sheriff Killingsworth, and they go into the West Bottoms down at 9th and Hickory. And Pretty Boy Floyd gets out of the car and he makes a phone call, and about 20 minutes later a car comes pulling around. And Pretty Boy Floyd and Adam Ricchetti, they offload all their guns and all their personal items into the car that's picking them up. And then they threaten Killingsworth and Walter Griffith to start walking and don't ever say anything or else we'll come back and hunt you down. You
yeah.
know? And Pretty Boy Floyd gave Sheriff Killingsworth his golf clubs when he exited the car. And so what happened when Pretty Boy Floyd came to town? Well, Pretty Boy Floyd he gravitated toward Kansas City all the time. Kansas City was Pretty Boy Floyd's favorite city because
he obviously had a network of people here. If he could call somebody and have them come and pick him up right away and take guns.
Absolutely. And Pretty Boy Floyd had already been in a big shootout in Kansas City at the Lusco Noto Flower Shop, which was a front for you know, alcohol distribution, but also was just part of the mob. There was a warren of rooms above the flower shop where all kinds of notorious and unsavory characters hung out, and Pretty Boy Floyd was involved in a prohibition bust there, and he shot it out with federal agents.
Is that location still in existence? So
the Lusco Flower
Shop.
Lusco
Noto Flower Shop. It's on Independence Avenue. I'd have to be given a moment
to
get that.
Yeah, that might be another good one for the Gangland or Mob Tours app.
Yeah.
We'll look that one up.
Yeah.
And they actually had a... So Pretty Boy Floyd had a shootout there with the police.
Oh,
earlier.
Yeah.
Not within the same context of June of
1933. No, just a couple of years before this, yeah. And he managed to escape, and a federal agent was killed in that, and an innocent bystander was killed as they were shooting at him as he was running out into the street. And one of the things is that after Pretty Boy Floyd served his original sentence at the Missouri Penitentiary in the mid-1920s, and was released. First place he came was Kansas City. Of course, got arrested for vagrancy. And, you know, they said, look, just leave town and we'll drop the charges. But he kept coming back to town all the time. But one of the things is he had said, I am never going to prison again. Mm-hmm. I will not be taken alive. I will do whatever it takes, but I am never going back to prison. And, frankly, he never was taken back to prison. And that's what made him so dangerous to lawmen.
Correct.
Because he had nothing to lose, and he meant every word. And Pretty Boy Floyd, the stocky, athletic, tough guy. You know, just he looks like he would have been a great high school wrestler or something like that. You know,
well, he was a dangerous guy. If you were a lawman, if you were just the average person on the street, he didn't have any.
No, he wasn't looking for trouble. And he grew up on a farm and a loving family, and so he was a people person. He enjoyed people. He had a beautiful wife, a wonderful wife. He had a great little boy. And so in many ways, he had a lot of positive attributes, although he also killed the husbands of the two women that he eventually went on the lam with when he went up to Buffalo, New York. He and another guy killed these two guys because, well, they just basically needed them out of the picture. So, you know, Pretty Boy Floyd developed into a real murderous character. So anyway, they get dropped off there at 9th and Hickory in the West Bombs. They get picked up by a car. Well, the car was sent by Dominic Benaggio. Mm. Now, Dominic Benaggio is the older brother of Charlie Benaggio, who would later lead the mafia in Kansas City in the 1940s and, of course, be executed on in Democratic headquarters on Truman Boulevard underneath a huge picture of Harry Truman, a very notorious mob hit. Well, this is Charlie's older brother, Dominic, who ran a bar in downtown Kansas City. It was the Sexton Hotel Bar. Trust me, he was no shrinking violet. He killed a man in his bar. One time. And so when Pretty Boy Floyd gets into town and Benaggio sends the car round for him to pick him up, Benaggio also, now this is, it's unknown whether he went and personally saw Johnny Lazio or he somehow got hold of him on the telephone, but Johnny Lazio used to hold court down at the Harvey restaurant at the Union Station. Johnny Lazio was there on June 16th, the night before the massacre went down. And it was there that Johnny Lazio came to learn of the fact that Pretty Boy Floyd was in town because Dominic Benaggio, comporting himself with the rules of governance of organized crime in Kansas City, he reported to Lazio, said, hey, I want you to know Pretty Boy Floyd is... in town, I've got him. I'm providing him safekeeping right now, and everything's fine, but I just want you to know he's here. Okay, well, thank you very much. It's good information to have. And then, shortly thereafter, Vern Miller arrives down at Union Station.
In the evening before.
In the evening before. And Lazzy is down there with his gang. You know, it's Gaetano Lococo and Mad Dog Gargatta and Sam Scola and Gus Fasone and Charlie Carolla and all these guys, right? They're all you know,
with
witnesses.
Their great monikers.
Right.
Probably
right.
Judge Louis Mizuch stopped by maybe once in a while, too. I got a picture of all those guys with Judge Louis Mizuch.
Is that right?
He was a sitting judge when I came on the police department, but he was sitting right on in the front row of them getting ready to make a political speech.
Oh, yeah. I just saw that recently on Facebook.
Right.
That is a great picture.
It is.
In fact, I wrote this fellow, said, man, that's a very important picture.
It is.
It says a lot.
Yeah, it does. You know, Johnny Lazzi is down there. Another guy that's down there is a guy named Jimmy Needles La Capra, and he was called Needles because he was a heroin addict. And he was Sam Scola's brother-in-law, and he was actually part of the coterie of Lazzi's gang at that moment. And so Vern Miller comes down to see Lazzi, and he says, I want to liberate my good buddy Frank Nash, who they're going to bring through Union Station tomorrow morning. Can I use some of your men? And Lazzi says, no, you can't use my men. We don't have any interest in this. But I'll tell you what, Pretty Boy Floyd's in town. How would you like to use him?
There you go.
And so that really is how they came together, because when Vern Miller said, yeah, that'll be fine, then Lazzi told Sam Scola, he said, fix him up. Get him, you know, get whatever weapons they need and introduce Vern Miller to Pretty Boy Floyd. Now, how all of that went down and what exactly was said, we'll never know. But it's fairly certain that
meeting did occur.
That those phone calls occurred and the meeting occurred, yes, absolutely. Now, some people, you know, would challenge that and say, well, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy theorists out there, and that's fine. You know, it kind of makes it fun, actually. But
yeah. They say that wasn't Pretty Boy Floyd at all.
Well, yeah, that's right. That's right. And I have my reasons why I strongly believe that Pretty Boy Floyd was engaged in it, but maybe we'll talk about that
okay.
when we get back. So
all
that's
right.
kind of what we've just okay. set the scene for everything that's all going right. on that's going to happen.
The night of June the 16th.
Yeah, 1933.
Everybody's together, 1933.
Right.
So, okay, let's wind this down and... I just want to remind you guys that Terrence has Black Hand Straw Man, a DVD. He has a companion book, if you like the books. He's also done a documentary called Tom and Harry about Harry Truman and Tom Pendergast and their relationships. And he has two websites. One's Black Hand Straw Man. You can find that pretty easily. And the other one is www.tomandharry.com. And he has other movies. He's got his Nellie Don movie and his Nellie Don companion book. And I don't know, what are you working on now? You got something you're working on right now? It's getting ready to come out, or are you still in the planning process?
Well,
you're always working on something.
I am working on something. We are writing the musical right now, Nellie Don.
Oh, I remember you told me about that. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, so we're going to make a musical out of Nellie Don. It has glamour, romance, politics, gangsters, and lots of beautiful fashions.
Cool.
You know?
And Terrence is a musician. He plays on Friday nights at...
Conroy's Irish Pub on 95th Street. That's right.
Correct. I've stopped out there and heard him. He kind of plays honky-tonk piano.
Is
that the style you would call
it? I was going to say, because it would all be for Nellie Don, you would have to have it as a period.
Oh, absolutely.
Music.
It's a period piece. And I love all of that, you know, 19-teens and 1920s jazz, you know, hot jazz and, you know, all that great stuff.
You should talk to some folks I know, Victor and Penny, if you've ever heard of them. They have an antique pop.
They do that
kind of a contemporary thing.
Oh, okay.
They would be really a good musical group.
Okay.
Or something like that, absolutely.
Right. Actually, Erin McGrain is on Facebook.
Okay.
And they do got some of their stuff.
They
are interesting.
She's been.
Anyhow, so let's wind this down. Don't forget that I have a donate button on my website, and I will give you a Gangland Wire T-shirt for a donation of $25 or more to pay for studio time. And I've done some freedom information requests for some other cases I'm working on that are upcoming. One of them is going to be about the attempted kidnapping of Muriel Kaufman for you Royals fans out there.
Wow,
it's an interesting story.
I did not know that story.
Yeah, and I have all the pictures, too. Oh. I'll tell you that in a minute.
Huh.
So,
which makes for a great podcast.
Which makes for a great podcast to have all the pictures, folks.
Well, but you also have the Mob Tours app. I think in this episode we probably came upon two or three more locations that you might want to add to your app if you update it, because you
Correct.
do that.
And I've been putting my podcast connecting them to the app, too. So you can listen, you can subscribe through iTunes, you can go to my website, ganglandwire.com, and listen, or you can go on and get my app at for a low, low price of $1.99 and listen to these podcasts.
Find the trap, find all the...
Find the trap, where Nick Civella lived when he was out and about, and where he was shot one time, and where the two Charlies were killed, Charlie Bonaggio and Charlie Gargatta. And you can see, I hooked little clips of Terrence's movie, Black and Strong Man, and clips from my movie to the app also.
And you also can find the bullet holes at the Union Station from the episode we're talking about right now.
All right. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Good night.